Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tortoise.
I'm hoping it outsells Liz Truss's book, but
by the way, it's got to outsell Liz Truss's book. You go home. That's it. That's the moment where you go home. All right, should we get started? This is a bonus episode of the News Meeting because after Will Hutton joined us for Monday's episode, I wanted to spend some more time talking about his new book, which is called This Time, No Mistakes, How to Remake Britain. If you're my age, you will have read, or most likely read, The State We're In, probably one of the most influential books of the 90s, and forced us to rethink what government could do, what post-Thatcher the market was there to do. No Mistakes This Time, if you like, is the book that said, well, that got us so far, but we need to go much further. And Will sets out in this book really a heartfelt cry for the UK to recognise the structural, cyclical trouble it's in. I think you use this phrase, Will.
Yeah.
The UK is much more far gone than it was when you wrote The State We're In. I have to confess, this may not be the roasting that you'd be hoping for, because there were periods where reading this book, I cheered. I thought, thank goodness, we're finally getting someone who's talking about the real scale of changes and reforms that we need. I'd like to get into some of those in detail to understand some of those. Okay. And particularly because I think people look at you and think, given your time editing The Observer, economics editor of The Guardian, your time in academia, the time that you spent advising companies too, and now the sense that you're also influencing what the Labour government might at least think about, I think people are really interested in the detail of what you're going to suggest. But I wanted to start, if I might, by just analysing, if you like, the two biggest choices of the last 14 years of Conservative government: austerity and Brexit.
Yeah.
Let's start with austerity. You give austerity quite a kicking in this book.
Yeah.
But was there not an argument for it that unless we got a grip on spending, there was going to be a risk that there would be a run on the pound and a financial crisis that would engulf the UK?
It was a question of degree. I mean, what Alistair Darling and Gordon Brown had set out in the wake of the great financial crash was a contraction in the budget deficit, but in a measured way, with broadly half the reduction being taken by tax increases and half the reduction being taken by public expenditure cuts. And, I mean, for me, that was reasoned. It didn't need to be kind of ratcheted up. And arguably, even what Brown and Darling was doing was a step too far, because Britain, like Western Europe and the United States and Canada, was about to enter what economists call a balance sheet recession. That's to say, the private sector in all these countries had overborrowed. Banks, which had been fueling growth, were drawing in their horns, and the private sector was going to contract. And in those circumstances, with interest rates at a kind of, you know, epic low, the state should step in. I mean, and that's kind of not just Keynesian economics, but that's kind of common sense. And that wasn't done. And actually, instead of even the reasoned kind of balanced approach that Darling and Brown set out, Osborne turned up the wick. And actually, almost all the burden of the deficit reduction was taken by public expenditure cuts. And some of the cuts were on the grounds that it was overblown, that the state was overblown and you should shrink the state to make room for private investment that would be crowded in by the absence of state borrowing. I don't believe in crowding out in that sense. I believe in crowding in private investment through public investment. I think it was exactly the wrong way around. That's the first thing to say. And the second thing to say is that, I mean, some of the expenditure cuts that were kind of inflicted on the non-protected parts of the public sector were kind of insupportably large with kind of results we face now. I mean, whether it be in the National Health Service, the very low number of kind of MRI scanners, whether it's what's happened to the court system or prison capacity. Sure Start has just been kind of examined by the Institute for Fiscal Studies. It was 3,500 centres in 2010. That's been shrunk to 1,000 centres. Mm-hmm. The impact on kids under five, both health impacts and education impacts, kind of in their teens, is kind of measurably fantastic. And that was kind of eviscerated. And, you know, just the kind of hard and soft infrastructure supporting our society were cut away in the name of the notion that there would be this run on the power, which I don't agree there ever would have been, and to shrink the state to create a kind of gap which the private sector would automatically fill, even though it was on its knees. It was just bad economic thinking, and the results are here for us to see.
And what's your view on the impact of austerity on growth?
I think austerity and Brexit together they've cost us growth in the very short term, that's obvious. But I think they've cut the long-run growth rate. I mean, the long-run growth rate, the OBR, the IMF, most respected economic forecasters would say that Britain's trend growth rate, which was, around 2.5 to 2.75% before the financial crisis, is now 1.25, 1.5%. It's nearly halved. And if you cut public investment, which went from 3% of GDP to broadly 1% of GDP, and is currently running around 1.25, 1.5, you cut public investment by that degree, and that takes away one prop of the economy, and then there's all the kind of elements like education and training. For example, there's only one apprenticeship for every three that people apply for. Vocational education in further education colleges, I mean, has been cut by 20% in real terms. And so you go on. And these things aren't kind of directly in the growth numbers, in the immediate growth numbers, but they affect trend growth because you don't have people coming forward in 5, 10, 15 years who've been through the same training process as they would have been before 2010.
So when you try to rank, if you like, the people, at least in the last decade or so, who've brought us to the place we are, George Osborne as, if you like, the force behind austerity.
Yes.
Let's say Michael Gove as the person who opened the door to Vote Leave and Boris Johnson's leadership of that particular cause. Johnson himself in a style of government levelling up, and then Liz Truss with a mini budget. When you think of those four people, who are the people that you think are at the top of the list of causing the stress and problems for the UK economy that are at the heart of this Time No Mistakes book?
I think I'd probably rank Brexit as a bit as a... it's very difficult, this. I mean, they're co-equal mistakes in my view.
And one
builds on the other, you know.
But Will, that's an important point. You think that austerity and Brexit are co-equal mistakes?
Yeah. I do. And Brexit may be a bigger mistake in that its impact is more enduring. I mean, Professor Nick Crafts, who's a distinguished economic historian, died recently, a great, great, great figure. He reckoned that the impact of being a member of the European Union was to lift GDP by 10% cumulatively above what it otherwise would have been. That was inward investment. You could see it in the car industry. It was our small and medium-sized enterprises becoming part of kind of European supply chains. it was the intensity of competition from European producers forcing British producers to get more productive. And all of that combined, and just trade intensity kind of was greater as a result of being in the single market and customs union. And actually that unravelling, we've lost half of that 10% already. I mean, the Goldman Sachs reckon it's 5% reduction. It will be, I think, 10% in 2030. And then it's ongoingly kind of a problematic. In a way, you can get back on your feet by raising public investment and shredding and kind of shrinking and kind of putting right the damage of austerity. So in a sense, I mean, they're co-equal at the moment, I think, in their impact. The longer an impact of Brexit is more serious.
So you wrote a teasing column in Sunday's Observer suggesting that essentially prime ministers over the last century had sooner or later realised that Britain's lot was in with Europe and the European market. And I think you ended it by saying something along the lines of, we're on the road again, or on the road back again.
Yes.
Right. It was a tease, though, Will, because it was like, oh, yes, well, we may be, but how long is it and how circuitous is it? So what's your view of what, assuming it is a Labour government, Keir Starmer's government does to set the UK down back on that road to a close relationship with Europe? In concrete terms, what does that involve?
Well, what I think they're going to do, and yes, and I do think that actually Harold Macmillan, who I rather admire, actually, and I think his book, The Middle Way, he wrote in 1938, was in many respects kind of, is in the same tradition as both This Time No Mistakes and The State We're In. I mean, it's a similar, we both took a similar view about how fundamental British structures had to change. And he took the view we had to join the common market, rebutted. Harold Wilson followed suit, and Ted Heath followed suit. They all recognised that our markets in the empire was going, and the markets were dead as a dodo, and that actually we had to affiliate to the European project. And I think they were right. I think two generations later, we see they're right. And in a way, you know, the recovery of laissez-faire economics, which has been so destructive, went hand in hand, actually, with the Thatcherite Euroscepticism. So to answer your question directly, I think they're going to go for a big and broad defence and security pact with the members of the European Union. Vital, by the way, and I think to demonstrate to kind of the mainstream Washington that actually Europe is going to do its bit. We need to. It was very important, as I've said, that Biden got and Michael Johnson, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, got this big support package through for Ukraine. But it's going to get harder and harder to do that unless people like that in the States can point, can see off their critics and say, look, the Europeans are stepping up to the plate. So I think a big baggy defence pact in the first 6 months, and it'll be broad. It'll be cybersecurity, it'll be data, it'll be energy, it'll be defence procurement, it will be, it may even be resilience and food supplies. And in that, you're talking about a fifth of GDP, up to a fifth of GDP, kind of defence contracting, agriculture, energy, data, cybersecurity. That's 15 to 20% of GDP. And in all those areas, we will have to align with kind of European standards in order to make that defence pact work. And that'll be sellable, in my view, to the British electorate, because they don't want Russian tanks in the Baltic republics and Poland any more than, you know, any more than, they just, you know, I mean, it's, Jacob Rees-Mogg and others are saying, if we can't go near all this, NATO will do it. It's kind of not, it isn't the way to, kind of geopolitics is working in 2024. And that becomes a bridgehead to follow up with other things. You can start, the Trade and Cooperation Pact comes up for renegotiation in 2025, next year as well. I think there's areas where big movement can be made on kind of financial services, creative industries, kind of aligning professional standards, mutual access to one another's markets. You know, you can start to see bridgehead after bridgehead being created. And by the way, it's vital. I mean, these people, you know, Europeans, we are Europeans. This market, this continent is us.
So then, Will,
it's only miles away. It's absurd, you know, trying to kind of isolate ourselves and imagine that we've got bigger friends in China, India and America. It's just not true.
So, Will, where does that leave you at the end of a parliament? At the same time, the European Union is, of course, increasing its membership. So you could see a membership of 35
member states. Are you a person who thinks that we end up with a Europe of, I hate these phrases, kind of different geometries?
Yes, yes. I'm sure that's going to be the way it works. I'm sure there's going to be, in a way, the European political community, which has got a... in fact, Rishi Sunak, if he remains Prime Minister in July, will be hosting at Blenheim Palace in Oxfordshire, heads of state from all over the European Union to discuss the situation in Ukraine primarily, but also kind of on the agenda will be energy security, will be food security, and other member states will insist, or other European countries will insist that climate change is, even though he doesn't want to touch it because of it's so toxic with the British right. But I mean, so you know, willy nilly, that's already emerging as part of the geography. And I do see a variable geography. I think that's the, there'll be some countries will be in the customs union. I mean, Switzerland has got a custom made kind of association with the European Union. Yeah. And I use the word in the book, and I don't know whether it'll be reassociation with the European Union, with something custom made along Swiss kind of lines, or whether we'll be able to ever muster or have the bravery to muster a second referendum in the early 2030s on rejoining the European Union kind of completely. I don't know how it's going to fall out, but I do know that there has to be a defence pact. I do know that in key sectors like creative industries and financial services, we have to have kind of much closer alignment with European regulations. And I do know that on these big geopolitical questions, we have to move in lockstep. And all of that points to variable geometry and reassociation at the very least, and maybe rejoining.
So let's get to the heart of the book. When you came in here, actually, into the office a few months ago, I think you were sort of coming to the end of writing the book, and you talked a little bit about what the motivations were for it, both what you'd seen in the UK, but the experience of having run at Oxford College and the experience of fellowship.
Yeah.
Start there, if you would. What does fellowship mean?
I did run at Oxford College for 9 years of my life, and I watched this kind of community of nearly 50 academics who double up as trustees of the charity that is in Oxford College, kind of behaving solidaristically, looking out for each other, having the college and what it does academically, kind of understanding their responsibilities to act as a collective, and actually supporting me kind of when my wife died, kind of in an extraordinary way, that all shapes and sizes of different people were amazing, you know, held me up actually in a moment of intense grief. But simultaneously, I mean, you know, academics, they are, you know, and quite rightly, come on, you know, they've got research interests, they plough their individual fellow, plough their individual course, and they've got individual agency. So they simultaneously kind of are members of this collective and behaving solidaristically, and also highly individualistically. And these are meant to be kind of incompatible value systems. But I watched at first hand the marriage of the two. And that's what I'm trying to argue in the book, that actually, you know, the idea that one can only be kind of an individualist because one believes in capitalism, or one can, if you believe in fellowship, one can only be a kind of a socialist, is kind of not where human beings are at, really. And that we are, and I argue for the marriage of an ethical socialism grounded in the notion of fellowship, looking out for each other, having each other's backs. I quote Clem Attlee, who, when asked what he understood by socialism, said, I follow the great citizen of this borough, using 19th century language, William Morris, who said, fellowship is the socialism is fellowship, and fellowship is the hope of the world. And that's my credo. And I quote him, and I get all that. And I think that kind of you run an organisation here, James, and there'll be kind of, in a sense, it's a social organisation as much as a capitalist organisation. And I'm sure you get that, because simultaneously, you know, you are trying to make your way. You're trying to kind of climb up. There'll be individuals here who want to build a career. They'll have individual agency. They're looking out for themselves and their families. And it kind of, that's the way it is. And this notion that, you know, you can only be kind of small state, individualistic, kind of red and tooth and claw, kind of doing down your fellow human beings, is kind of, there's one vision. And the other vision is for kind of, you know, we all march in lockstep in kind of socialist paradise. It's kind of ludicrous. You know, and so in the book, I try to say you have a kind of, there's an ethic of socialism understood as fellowship, which should provide a floor in our lives, and simultaneously there's this notion of progressive liberalism in which, yes, you know, I have responsibility to society and society has responsibility to me, but thus I am strengthened in the kind of things I want to do as an individual, to build my life, to have ambition, to look after people I care about, and actually drive my company forward. And the kind of capitalism I'm imagining would be kind of much more stakeholder-oriented, much more kind of mindful of its obligation to the society of which it's part simultaneously. So that's my vision.
And I should say that, you know, since you came in here and we had that conversation about fellowship, it really has felt to me like the answer to something that we've been looking for since we started Tortoise. When you looked at the power gap, when you looked at the mess we were in constitutionally, when you looked at the extent to which the marketplace was falling short of delivering on the kind of values that Mark Carney talked about when he was governor of the Bank of England. All of that really, really chimed with me. And I guess what I'm interested in now is beginning to, if you like, do the colouring in. If fellowship is the outline, what does the colouring in look like? And will I sort of drill into like one line in your book that I thought was really fascinating? To be honest with you, it's not the most interesting line in the book, but it is in service of the big idea of fellowship and mutual responsibility. Because I thought very early on in the book you wrote this one thing, which was about, you say, we must learn to invest in ourselves and build the public and private institutions to do that.
Yeah.
So there's this question about what will the institutions be? How will they work? And then this is the fundamental sentence, it seems to me, of the whole thing. Strategically, the task is to use much increased public investment within a credible fiscal framework supported by the reshaping of our savings and investment landscape in order to mobilise the hundreds of billions that are necessary to invest in a new generation of great companies and great infrastructure. That's the whole thing.
Yeah, right? That's the whole thing.
And I just wondered
So
the thing that I want to do, if I might, is rather than just bounce around the book, literally just take that sentence apart.
Okay.
And do one thing after another and just try and get to each element of it.
Okay. So let's start with
what your version is of these public and private institutions. What do you think we've got that works, and what do you think we need, because we're either lacking the institutions or the institutions we've got don't work well enough?
Okay, let's talk about public investment first. I do think, after lots of kind of false starts, that the UK Infrastructure Bank is a really interesting institution.
Right.
I mean, I think the UK Infrastructure Bank could take on the could shoulder much of the burden of kind of decarbonising the economy, actually. So that's one institution which I think really should be scaled up big time. I do think that on terms of innovation, and we have a network, you probably may never heard of them, but I had a hand in their formation back in the day, 2010. They're called Catapults.
Yeah.
And their job is to kind of identify kind of clever stuff that's going on in the frontiers of technology in the particular areas that they're operating. It could be vaccines, it could be space, it could be high-tech manufacturing, it could be robotics. And then kind of diffuse that knowledge kind of into kind of companies it's identified with who have the capacity to kind of use the kind of frontier technology, invest in it, help them find markets, sometimes co-partner with them. I mean, it's done very well in Germany and France. But anyway, look, there's lots and lots of things.
But the spirit of it is, let's use the power of the state, the balance sheet of the state, to increase investment, public investment, that gets private investment in.
Exactly.
And you can hear some people cheering and some people shuddering. And the ones who are shuddering are thinking, oh no, here they come, the left. They're just going to end up
borrowing more, spending more than we've got. So let's come to the second element of this sentence. We're going to increase public investment within a credible fiscal framework. Now, I can almost hear listeners to this podcast thinking, now is the time to tune into the tortured poets department. Maybe I should give that a listen. But can we get into credible fiscal framework, Will? Because it feels to me as though there are two kind of caricatured views of this. One is, beware people who meddle with the fiscal rules, because what they're doing is just encouraging politicians to borrow, borrow, borrow. And then there are other people who say, no, the Treasury is the villain here. They endlessly straitjacket us into a set of rules on tax spend and borrowing that mean we never invest in the future of the UK. So what's your version of a credible fiscal framework?
Well, just to pick up that last point, and then I'll go straight to the heart of the matter. I mean, I think I've come to the view that actually, I mean, all institutions have a kind of, you work for the BBC, all institutions have a kind of culture, which is very hard to kind of, they're path dependent. And one of the culture of the Treasury is to be extremely skeptical about public investment. And I think we have to, you know, we can't live with that anymore as a country. And I would actually kind of break it up into one element would be an orthodox kind of finance ministry role, and then another role would be kind of strategic financial oversight or growth oversight, if you like. So, you know, that's
so an economy ministry,
yes,
and a finance ministry.
Yes, I do. I just think, you know, that, I mean, the Americans do it. You know, I don't see why we shouldn't have something similar. But a fiscal framework, for me, is about kind of four or five things. One, please don't freak out about the size of the national debt in absolute numbers. You know, what you've got to look at is the assets alongside the liabilities. So if our national debt, our economy is worth £2.5 trillion, roughly the national debt is £2.5 trillion. But actually, what matters is the assets, you know, the hospitals, the schools, the roads, the ports. And actually, that balance sheet has gone negative in Britain. Because we've sold off so much, and we haven't, our public investment's been too low for so long. And so one part of having credible fiscal rules is actually to put on the table firmly that actually the job of the state is at the very least to make sure that the public balance sheet kind of doesn't deteriorate and hopefully gets stronger. And you don't say you don't want it negative as it is at the moment. So that gives you the permission to say to the financial markets, we are trying to kind of remedy something and they know what, they can see weakness, actually, the financial markets.
This is the idea of net worth.
This is the idea of public sector net worth. This is the idea of actually looking at the net worth of the public sector. So that should be one of the kind of, if you've got a series of dials on your dashboard, that should be kind of the centrepiece dial. Then you want to make sure that over an economic cycle, 5, 7, 8 years, that actually current spending and current revenues, day-to-day spending and day-to-day revenues actually balance. You know, I think you should also ensure that you can borrow for capital investment, but it should always have positive kind of returns. It should be kind of secured by Office of Budget Responsibility. And another thing, which isn't really kind of a fiscal rule, but I think it needs to be on the table, is let's get kind of level-headed about taxation. I mean, the difficulty with that taxation at the minute is it's about 36% of GDP, tax receipts. It may get to 37, which would mean it would become a post-war high. It's already at a post-war high, income tax, VAT, national insurance, and ordinary people. Wealth as a share of national income has doubled in the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. But the proportion of receipts coming in from the wealthy has not doubled. And that should be put right. And that does mean we have to attend to things like council tax. If we are still, if you and I are still living in a country in 2050 in which the council tax is based on residential values in 1991, which is at the moment, we will live in a failed state. So, you know, there's kind of, all that together gives you the permission, I think, to kind of raise public investment significantly, to trigger the rise in private investment, which the other part of the sentence talks about.
So yes, I get that.
A long answer. I'm sorry about
this. That's a massively important answer. That these are all fundamental. If you like, the third and final element, though, of the sentence
is, as you say, about public investment prompting private investment. But you say it in relation to this
Will. You say, to invest in a new generation of great companies and great infrastructure, which, you know, anyone who's following this will either think, hallelujah, someone who's committed to industrial strategy, or here come the white elephants. So how do you make sure that those great companies and great infrastructure are well chosen and not a waste of public funds?
Well, I've got, Britain does well creating great companies, actually. I mean, the trouble is they all wind up being owned by someone else. I mean, after the Chinese and the Americans, we create more unicorns. That's to say companies worth kind of $1 billion or more than any country on earth. But most of them have wound up being kind of owned by particularly Americans or by Europeans, because we don't have a financial system that actually gets behind our companies, and we don't have a buoyant enough stock market that makes their worthwhile selling into a UK stock market. They find that their exit is they end up owned by someone else. And so, you know, if we want, you know, great companies to be headquartered in Manchester, Leeds, Bristol, kind of, you know, Edinburgh, Cardiff, and to kind of offer opportunity, apprenticeships, career opportunities, wealth for those cities, we need them to be kind of stay in the UK. So I kind of, you know, so it's huge. So I want to see some home bias in the way our financial system is set up. I mean, Northumbria University, improbably, but why not, has got more startups near the university kind of in the UK, you know, and yet the system to kind of allow them to scale up to become great companies that would rejuvenate Tyneside is negligible, you know. So, and people say, oh, well, you know, you might lose money. But I mean, venture capitalists know that. Private equity knows that. Kind of anyone in the game knows that, you know, if you invest in a kind of 100 startups, you know, kind of 30 will fail, 30 will be so-so, 20 will kind of will begin to show signs of life, and the last 5, the last 10 will really fly.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have to think like that. And of course the public sector should partner with the private sector in doing this. And we shouldn't just kind of be kind of terrified about failure. We should be thinking, bloody hell, you know, there's enough talent in the country to generate a wonderful new generation of great companies. And I don't know about you, but when I go around some a really successful company, British company, you know, it fills me with joy. You know, I can't to see these young men and women have built something up from scratch, and there it is, you know, vibrant, doing something, and often actually very purposeful, wanting to make. You know, they had some idea at university, and they thought, we could change the world with this, and bloody hell, they do it, and it's just fantastic. And yet, I don't want to see it all kind of drifting through our fingers. One of the things I really criticise about the Brexiters, and actually many people on the right, is they don't talk this language. Mm-hmm. They talk in abstracts about taking back control, about sending immigrants back to, asylum seekers back to Rwanda, and. But, you know, they don't talk about how to build Britain up as a kind of great liberal capitalist power, which is what is in our hands to do.
So I suspect that Liz Truss. No. I'm interested because I've got one final question for you, Will, which is I suspect that Liz Truss is not going to love your book.
No,
it's possible.
I'm hoping that people buy my book rather. I buy it seller.
But that world that is animal spirits, Singapore on Thames, take back control, they're not necessarily going to love an argument which is we need to think more seriously about public investment that enables private investment, that promotes a, you know, 21st century industrial strategy. The thing that I worry about is the extent to which Rachel Reeves loves your book. And can you explain to me why, when you set out an argument like this, so little of it seems to reach the shadow chancellor, the leader of the opposition, why it seems that we're taking on trust that they're reading your stuff, they're listening to you and other kind of economists with your mindset, but we never really hear an articulated version with the kind of detail that you set out for us from the leaders of the prospective Labour government?
Yeah, look, I mean, I, 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 I mean, it was a surprise to me. I mean, Keir Starmer agreed to come along to an event I had last week, actually. And he came as a surprise guest. He stayed for half an hour. And he told the audience that they should... It was a brilliant book, and they should buy it. And then, who hadn't read it should. So I was kind of my jaw dropped open. And he has read it, and there are traces of it. And I labour thinking. I mean, I.
But do you think it's risky, Will? Because some people say, you know, not everything in this book is going to be a brilliant idea. Let's face it. Some of them are going to need to be road tested, examined.
It's a direction of travel. I actually say that, by the way. It's a direction of travel. I actually say that. Actually, you know, it's iterative. You know, you try some some of that stuff should be tried. If it fails, drop it.
But isn't the risk that this
scale up the stuff that works?
But isn't the risk that the political prudence of Keir Starmer is getting in the way of good judgment when it comes to future government, i.e. unless you really kick the tires on some of these ideas now, the notion that somehow you're going to get into number 10 and ta-da, you're going to be able to initiate all of these things without having had a full debate before the general election, isn't that a mistake?
Look, I think so. You know, so I'm in agreement with you. I mean, I wish... I thought the Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves May's lecture, there were traces of my thinking in there, and I was pleased to see it, and told her so. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, in the five missions they have, there's traces of some of the things I talk about in the book. Remember that the Labour Party nearly split in 2019. They're the biggest kind of defeat in their history since 1935 on December the 12th, 2019. You know, even 2 years ago, they were still trailing the Tories in the polls. You know, their self-confidence is at a low ebb. And, you know, and they feel, you know, that they're holding this Ming vase of potential electoral victory and this approach of stripping down everything, showing as little kind of leg as you can, and nothing for the Tories to aim at, has got them to a turning point leading the polls, and they're going to stick with that strategy. And I kind of understand it. I actually think now is a moment to actually start talking kind of this language that you and I have been talking in this podcast.
Well, Will, thank you.
Well, thank you. I mean, I hope I haven't bored you.
No. Honestly, I think that this conversation and the conversation that you kind of articulate in the book is what you kind of wish political journalism was about these days, in that everyone in the country, I think I saw a Ipsos poll the other day saying that over two-thirds of people thought the country was headed in the wrong direction, 15% thought in the right direction. You can't change direction unless you really rethink things. And, you know, for what it's worth, This Time No Mistakes really forces you to have a go at rethinking things. So thank you. This Time No Mistakes is out now. Do go out, buy it, read it, think about it. Giles is going to be back with another episode of the News Meeting on Friday. Please do join him then. I'll be back for the News Meeting on Monday.
Tortoise.
Hello, it's Tomini from Tortoise. This podcast is sponsored by EY. Safe, efficient and reliable railways help to keep us all connected, thanks to Network Rail. Yet, maintenance on the railways is a risky and sometimes fatal business. At Network Rail, two previous attempts to invigorate its track worker safety programs had failed, leaving employees feeling sceptical that the organisation could ever get railway safety right. Since 2019, EY teams have worked with Network Rail to deliver a transformation that improved safety protocols and changed employee behaviour around safety. Network Rail RailHub, a new digital safety platform and app, eliminated inaccurate paper trails and worked offline, so it could be used by workers in remote locations. Since the platform was introduced, near misses affecting maintenance workers on the railways have fallen by 40%. Read the full story at ey.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.